The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jonathan Edelman, professor at the University of Denver's Korbel School of International Studies and an expert on Israel and the Middle East. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish experts on the international scene, Tom Price, our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, and a new contributor, poet Liz Schallenberger. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Not that I'm a prophet or anything, as we say in Hebrew, lo navi velo ben navi, but sometimes it's amazing to watch news events and have known in advance what was going to happen. So it was this week on the Syrian border with Israel. After nearly 40 years of quiet, dating from shortly after the Yom Kippur War, the Golan Heights border suddenly became a problem 4 weeks ago. It all started the day before I landed in Israel. I was on my short trip in mid-May. On the so-called Nakba Day, Palestinians remembering the founding of the State of Israel in 1948 with protests and mourning rituals. Lovely, no? It's like if Canada had special rituals for the 4th of July in which they burned American flags, staged sit-ins, and tried to blow up American buses. Anyway, on that day, mobs of Palestinians and other unoccupied young Arab men suddenly rushed the Israeli border, unimpeded by the Syrian army or police, who never otherwise let anyone get anywhere near the border. At the time, Israel was not well prepared to counter this peculiar and disturbing human wave tactic. In fact, the morning after it happened, I sat in an Israeli foreign ministry conference room with a group of other rabbis, and they kept rescheduling who was going to meet with us, because they were holding their own meetings on what their response would be to this brand new provocation. After wild reports in the international media circulated, hundreds of Palestinians killed, the Israeli border breached at multiple points, no, everywhere, and one potentially true weird story, apparently one of the gate crashers got through and actually hitched a ride to Tel Aviv with some peace activists. The military later arrested him sitting in an Israeli cafe. Anyway, the question is, where did these crazy people suddenly come from? And why had they decided all at once to pursue this quixotic tactic of violating an international border, a shooting offense in every country in the world? Well, to judge from the media reports last week, I'm not sure Israel has quite figured out the best way to respond to this weird method of putting additional diplomatic and media pressure on it. On the new commemoration of Naksa Day, I learned the word last week, just like everybody else, which apparently remembers the day in the Six-Day War when Israel recaptured Jerusalem from the country of Jordan, which had attacked Israel, and when Israel captured the Golan Heights from the invading Syrians. Anyway, on that day, about 150 Syrians, or Palestinians coming from Syria perhaps, somehow managed to cut the razor wire and cross the international border and set up shop just inside of Israel. The IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, warned them, then shot tear gas, and then actually shot at the legs of the lead demonstrators. Here are the facts. And make sure you quote Too Jewish on this one and Rabbi Sam Kohan, although the information actually comes from the Syrian resistance movement, the movement that's trying to topple the brutal Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, who is a murdering optometrist. Now that just sounds wrong, doesn't it? But it's true. Anyway, in order to distract world attention from the crimes against humanity that Assad is perpetrating on his own Syrian people, and the brutal murder of thousands of Syrian citizens by the Syrian army in the past few weeks, as Assad struggles to hold on to power, and the mass graves, and the torture, and the slaughter of 13-year-olds and women by Assad's troops, he now has fomented a problem on the Israeli-Syrian border quite on purpose. Mind you, Ever since the end of the 1973 Yom Kippur War, this border has been very quiet, kept so by both the oppressive Syrian army and by Israel. I have been up near that border several times, ridden a jeep along it. I can tell you that nothing approaches the Syrian side of that border. Not a Druze farmer, not a goat, not a field mouse without the permission of the Syrian army. That's been true for close to 40 years. And now, suddenly, hundreds of civilians can cross into Israel without restraint? How does this happen? Well, the Reform Party of Syria says that apparently the lovely Bashar al-Assad, a true son of his brutal dictator father, Hafez al-Assad, is now paying impoverished Syrian farmers from the drought-stricken northern part of the country, nowhere near Israel, about $1,000 apiece to show up at the Israeli border and pretend to be outraged Palestinians. If they happen to get killed, Assad promises their families an additional $10,000. Now we know the value of the life of a Syrian Arab, apparently. And of course, once these farmers are assembled, the Syrian army shows them how to get through their own minefields on their side of the border, gives them free passage to the border fence, and provides them with bolt cutters. I guess they actually have to use their own hands to operate the bolt cutters, or the whole scheme wouldn't work. All this is a desperate attempt to distract international attention from the genocide the Syrian army is perpetrating inside its own country. After all, if they can find a way to stir up trouble with Israel, they won't have to face the music on the Assad regime's murdering ways of clinging to power. This, of course, is a very old Arab tactic. It used to work as a means of letting off steam internally. When the people of Syria or Egypt or Lebanon or Iraq get tired of terrible economies, repressive regimes, and corrupt leadership, well, those leaders get everybody riled up about Israel and the poor benighted Palestinians and hope the riots go that direction. And now the Syrians are trying to use the same tactic on the credulous world media and European and American public opinion. When you are slaughtering hundreds of people and burying them in mass graves outside of Syrian towns, it is best to pay poor, ignorant farmers and bring them to the Israeli border and yell that Israel is killing innocent Palestinians. Spontaneous demonstrations, my eye. Have there ever been more cynical regimes in world history than the Arab dictatorships and sheikhdoms, still holding on to power by their fingernails? These are Nazi tactics used by Nazi-loving, anti-Semitic Arab kleptocracies. It looks like their era is over, but the evil tactics are still being employed in this, their endgame. Well, to play us in this morning, a song from that long-ago war, the Yom Kippur War, the last time the Syrian border was breached. It's sung here by Chava Alberstein, the classic song Lu Yehi. May all good things that we desire come to be.
Od yesh mifras lavan ba'ofek mul anan shachor kaved kol shenevakesh lu yehi ve'im b'chalonot ha'erev or nirot ha'chag ro'ed kol shenevakesh lu yehi. בדלת תן מילה טובה בפיו כל שנבקש לו יהי אם נפשך למות שואלת מפריחה ומאסיף כל שנבקש לו יהי לו יהי
That That was Lou Yehi, sung by the great singer Chava Alberstein. In happier news, when we return on Two Jewish, we'll talk with Jonathan Adelman, an expert on the Middle East and Israel and, well, all international relations, find out what the Arab Spring means for Israel and the Western world when we come back on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, "To find balance in life is to find happiness." Now, I assume he was a smart guy, being a philosopher and all. So it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza, too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this, what one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese, heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce, crispy crust or lightly done crust. It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness. And that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish Dr. Jonathan Adelman. He's a professor at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies. He's been at Denver University since 1978, which is a long time. He's also served as a professor at both People's University and Peking University in China, and has had a number of both academic and organizational positions over the course of an illustrious career, which included being the doctoral dissertation advisor for Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice before she was Secretary of State, of course. Good morning.
Good morning.
So can you explain the Arab Spring to all of us?
Well, first of all, the Arab Spring is very overdue. You know, after the end of the Cold War and the disintegration of Soviet Union in 1991, we had spring, you know, sprouting all over the world. We had almost 70 new democratic countries. We had the Eastern European countries became democratic and also capitalist. And we had tremendous transformation. The only area in the entire world that was the black hole of this new world order was in the Middle East. So this is really at least 20 years overdue. Then the question is, what does it mean for us? And I think what we've seen in recent weeks is we now have a very different understanding of this than we did when things just started in Tunisia and, of course, in Egypt back in January and February. Now we see that many of the autocratic, corrupt rulers are trying very hard to hang on. We see that with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. We see it with Bashar Assad in Syria. We've seen it until the last couple of days with Ali Saleh in Yemen and in Bahrain. And so we've seen that what many people thought was this irresistible wave, just like 1989 in Eastern Europe, has turned out to be fairly resistible, although maybe overcome. So we're seeing a different analysis here. We're seeing the Egyptian military in full control right now in Egypt. And so the obvious question is, what does it mean for us as Americans, us as Jews, and for us as supporters of Israel?
So, you know, of course, that is the question. We ask that about everything. What does it mean for us?
For us, it's not surprisingly a very mixed bag. You know, as Americans and as Jews who came to this country for democracy, for a free enterprise system, for the much lesser prejudice in the United States, and for opportunities, both economically, politically, and religiously, it's a very mixed bag. And the reason it's a very mixed bag is this is not Central Europe. This is not Germany and Japan after World War II with, you know, advanced economies, well-educated citizens, you know, major participants in the global economy. Revolutions basically bring the masses into politics. And in this particular, and even in the case of France or Germany in the 1930s, this turned out to be rather dangerous. But in this case, it's much worse because the masses here are very poorly educated. In some areas, they're actually lower than parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So in Egypt, for example, you have 42% of all Egyptian Muslim women are illiterate and 21% of the males. So about a third of the Muslims who make up 90% of the population are illiterate. And if you throw in a semi-literate, probably half the Egyptian population is either fully illiterate or semi-literate. And they bring their prejudices with them, as we have seen so often, and not just in the German case. You know, they bring the fact that in recent polls, 95% of them are anti-Semitic, 80% dislike the United States, 60% personally dislike Barack Obama, 54% believe in sexual segregation of women in public places, 52% want to get rid of the Camp David Peace Accord. So, you know, we love the image of those, you know, young, democratic, secular demonstrators in Tahrir Square and elsewhere. But
connected.
What we ignore is what about the rest of the people? And the rest are not quite the loving Democrats that we might imagine them to be.
Yeah, we've got a Facebook revolution leading illiterates. It's fascinating. We will talk much more with Professor Jonathan Edelman about the Middle East when we come back on Too Jewish.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-owned egg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation. just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome a new guest contributor here on Two Jewish, poet Liz Schallenberger. Her first offering is on a great text we read in Temple last week on Shavuot, the Book of Ruth.
What they don't tell you about Ruth. Whither thou goest, I will go, one dusty foot after the other, my arm wrapped tightly around your waist, my body slaked by the simple contact of skin. Your people will be my people. Take me home to your city of Jews. Teach me the secrets of Shabbos. At night, whisper the story of your people, your tongue in my mouth, your hand on my breast, and your God will be my God.
Thanks, Liz. We look forward to your poems for the next few weeks and any other Jewish poems you write.
Thanks, Rabbi. I'm looking forward to it.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, there's a lot of talk always in society about Israel and Palestinians, but there have been some recent forums that were supposed to be about enlightenment and maybe were about something else. Can you talk about that process?
Yes. Actually, just recently, I went to a series of talks, and including a theater show and a film that was hosted here in Tucson, and I won't mention the exact place, that was presented to be as a peace-seeking, justice-seeking program that was promoted as a place for a dialogue. And I must tell you, I went there with some of my friends, and I was extremely disturbed because the entire program not only was one-sided, but was focused on demonizing Israel, twisting history, spreading hatred and lies in order to present Israel and the Israelis as some kind of evil, of monsters. And I must share with you, you know, I sat there in the room and I was very disturbed because it reminded me very dark times where people that presented themselves as representing good and justice did very evil deeds. And also, you know, we hear those calls for boycott, for instance, on Israel. And those calls really remind us of dark times where Jewish products were boycotted. And to some extent, when we boycott a person, a group, a country, we create an atmosphere that later on allows bad weeds to grow wild. And that atmosphere is the one that later on leads to violence and to murders.
So it kind of legitimizes completely immoral conduct because you put that entity, whether it's a country or a religious group, outside the realm of civilization. It's like making them outlaws. You can do anything you want to them. They don't count as human beings. They don't count as part of the civilized world.
That's what I felt when I went there. And I was very disturbed by the fact that those groups are constantly presenting themselves as voices of peace, voices of justice, while they're actually promoting a very dark, in some ways racist, propaganda.
Well, we hope they don't succeed, and we'll continue to try to watch this process because, while it doesn't directly affect, say, Israel, doesn't hurt Israel's economy, it certainly doesn't help Palestinians any. It seems to be part of a larger program that's kind of ugly. Hopefully we will find some better ways of dealing with it. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Weiler of Janos J Bar and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails is a wonderful new place, maybe the best in Arizona.
Well, we just won Best New Restaurant in Tucson.
I heartily concur. What's your favorite stuff on the menu?
There's so many things that we do well downtown. It's really the foods of the entire world. And so at lunch, we do this great pounded Laotian pounded papaya salad. At dinner, have the trout. Trout with oysters and cream corn. Late night, you got to have the downtown burger.
And you can hear great music there late night too, can't you?
You don't have to go to bed early. You can stay up late Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, listen to live jazz, great specials on the late night menu, great drinks, incredible cocktails we make there, by the way. It's in the name.
I have to say, try the Game Changer Soup, too. What's the phone number for Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails?
623-7700.
Or it's www.downtownkitchen.com.
That's it.
We'll see you there, Janos.
Thank you.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, Lawrence Eagleburger died recently, just last week. He was the only career Foreign Service officer ever to become Secretary of State. It's always a political appointment. You knew him well. He was most importantly, I think for our listeners' purposes, known as a great friend of Israel. And the Israelis really liked him in an administration that they didn't like very much often when the first George Bush was president.
Right.
And James Baker had been the previous Secretary of State. Still a name that Israelis don't like. Can you tell us a little bit about Lawrence Eagleburger?
Yeah. First of all, I worked for him when he was the American ambassador in Belgrade, and that included the time when Tito died and hundreds of heads of state and other dignitaries came for the funeral, which was quite a procedure. And then I worked for him when he was undersecretary for political affairs in Washington, to which he was promoted from his position as Assistant Secretary for European Affairs, where I also worked for him. And I have to say, without any hesitation, he was the best boss I ever had. Just a wonderful human being. Many people labor under the misconception that he was Jewish. That's not the case. He was of German stock from central Wisconsin. His wife was also of German stock, or actually his second wife, but the one, only one that I knew, Marlene, who died recently as well. He, first of all, had a real humble, self-deprecating way about him that everybody found endearing. And when he was like number three in the State Department, pretty powerful position, he'd answer his phone, "Tilly's Flophouse, Molly speaking," and people on the other end were just like totally flummoxed. They had no idea what to say, and he loved that. He loved like catching people off guard. He also had a way of generating tremendous loyalty among his employees because he trusted you until you let him down. And in my case, I guess I was lucky because he trusted me enormously and gave me, well, he also gave me incredible challenges. I mean, a good example, once when he was ambassador in Belgrade, we were in the soundproof conference room that's supposed to be spy resistant, whatever. And we had a visitor, a fairly important person from the Department of State from Washington in town, and we're all sitting around, and there are all these senior guys from the embassy, and I'm a first tour junior officer, very young, very green. Wasn't even sure why I was at this meeting. So Eagleburger turns to me, and to the great surprise of everyone in the room, but nobody was as surprised as me, says, "All right, Tom, in 60 seconds or less, tell us what's going to happen after Tito dies. What will happen to this country?" So I kind of stammered and thought for a second. He said, "Okay, you have 50 seconds left." And then I spoke for 45 seconds. I was watching my watch, and I finished. And he looks around the table and says, "Anybody have anything to add?" nobody spoke up. He said, thank you very much. Meeting dismissed. And that was that. And that, as they say in Casablanca, was the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
It's a great story. He was known, you know, for really caring about Israel. And I remember during the when the Scuds were falling on Israel and Israel was precluded from fighting back against Saddam Hussein because of the big coalition that had been assembled with lots of Arab states, Eagleburger went to Israel while the Scuds were coming down.
He insisted on going there personally and standing shoulder to shoulder with them while the Scuds were falling on Tel Aviv, and that's where he was. He was always a huge friend of the Jewish people and of the Jewish state. And one of the reasons he was that he said that he felt the U.S. government could never do enough to make up for its inaction during the Holocaust. And he felt that we could never do enough to make up for that and all the lives lost. He also had a firm belief that Jews were smarter than everybody else.
Well, he was right about that, certainly. Thanks for those great memories of Lawrence Eagleburg. May he rest in peace.
Zichrono levracha. Thanks.
We'll talk next week, Tom. And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Fifteen-year-old Jonathan, a Jewish Boy Scout in training, is on his first wilderness trip learning about survival. Together with 10 other teenagers and Moshe, their group leader, they've arrived at their destination, a deep forest. There are no other people for miles. Moshe asks Jonathan to help him unpack the survival equipment. As he unpacks, Jonathan finds rope, hunting knives, flashlight, matches, compasses, flares, two-way radios, and emergency rations. But what surprises him is a sealed cardboard box with a mug and David on it, labeled "Ingredients plus recipe for making matzo balls." He says, I don't understand this box, Moshe. Why do I need to know how to make matzo balls? How is this going to help me if I get stranded? Take my word on this, Jonathan, replies Moshe. Should you, God forbid, ever find yourself in a forest with no food, howling wolves around you, no shelter, darkness creeping in, and you're scared to death because you're all alone, take out the matzo ball kit and follow the instructions. I promise you, within minutes, there'll be 6 Jewish women around telling you what you're doing wrong and how to make a perfect matzo ball. That was the old Jewish joke of the week special featured to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha in the book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout the land and see if it can be captured. The spies take a month. They see the whole land and report back to Moses that the land is very good, flowing with milk and honey. They bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so big it needs to be carried by 2 men on a pole, now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything's going to be great, but it's not. 10 of the 12 spies report that the people of the land are huge. We felt like grasshoppers next to them, they say, and numerous. The cities are fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance, in spite of having God's support. 2 spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report. They say that with God's help, this land can be taken, but the people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, "Why'd you take us out of slavery, only to kill us at the hands of our enemies?" At this point, the decision is made by God. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in just one generation. And so, after a failed, leaderless attempt to invade the land without God's approval, the people are condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 more years, total of 40 since they left Egypt, until a new young generation will emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a mentality of freedom. It's a great lesson in the process required to cleanse the trauma of oppression and failure from the minds of a community. Often, It's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people or a country. It's the generational turn that comes from learning that things can be done differently and that freedom is a birthright. When we come back on Too Jewish, the outstanding Middle East analyst Jonathan Edelman will explain to us what has been going on during this Arab Spring and what it'll mean for the future of Israel. We'll be back in a moment on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The anti-circumcision movement in California has taken a turn for the anti-Semitic. In a horrific new comic strip emailed to nearly everybody in San Francisco, where an anti-circumcision measure is on the ballot in the fall, a horribly stereotyped Nazi-style Jew with a big nose, dark hair, and a beard is the terrible Moyle, trying to cut off the foreskin of a beautiful blonde baby boy, while his blonde mother is restrained from protecting him. Suddenly, the Captain America-style blonde foreskin man, I'm not making this up, breaks in and saves the child from the brutal Jewish monster Moyle. You know, this is awful. There is no medical justification for this measure against circumcision on the ballot in San Francisco, but they can vote for anything. But there is certainly a great deal of unvarnished Nazi propaganda-style old-school anti-Semitism in that campaign, and it's bringing out the worst in some very bad people. We can only hope that some rational types step up and stop this anti-Jewish rhetoric, and that this unconstitutional and racist measure fails dismally at the ballot box. In an unrelated news item, but focused on the same area of the body, an embarrassing story that is simply too obvious to be true, and yet is, U.S. Congressman Anthony Weiner, a 46-year-old Jewish pro-Israel Democrat from Brooklyn, the subject of a fawning profile in the Jewish Moment magazine this month, and a rising star in Democratic political circles, apparently is the latest guy who can't resist sending phone camera pictures of his, well, privates to young women. Weiner has been a very successful, very vocal, and staunchly pro-Israel congressman with clear ambition to become the next mayor of New York, and perhaps more. Weiner's new wife, Huma Abedin, is a top aide to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and former President Bill Clinton did their wedding last July. Weiner has particularly attracted attention as a successful, vocal Jewish congressman married to a Muslim woman who grew up in Saudi Arabia. Big things were predicted for this loud champion of liberal causes and of Israel. And now, the seven-time congressman has become a punchline, brought down by a bizarre need to send personally intimate shots to young women who were not Anthony Weiner's wife. Not since Brett Favre ruined his great reputation doing similar things has anything quite so dumb occurred. You know, it is remarkably stupid and immature, even for a congressman, but especially a 46-year-old married congressman. But for a guy named Weiner to send photos of, well, his namesake, that are now going to be available on the web borders on deliberate political suicide.
Actually, it doesn't border on it. It is political suicide. The so-called Wienergate scandal has led to numerous headlines. Is Wiener cooked was one, the Battle of the Bulge, and so on. And then there's David Letterman's top 10 list about questions to ask yourself before tweeting a photo of your, you know. Do I have a last name that would make this especially embarrassing? So, Anthony Wiener, a former roommate and good friend of comedian and talk show icon Jon Stewart, also Jewish, joins New York Governor Eliot Spitzer as infamous New York politicians we wish weren't Jewish. Oy. And in sad news, not related to the same subject, thank God, former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger, a diplomat and administrator well-loved by Israel and Israelis, passed away last week at the age of 80. In 1992, Eagleburger took over for Secretary of State James Baker when he left to take over George Bush's, the first George Bush's, struggling presidential reelection campaign. Eagleburger was the only Foreign Service career officer to ever become Secretary of State. He later headed the Holocaust Claims Commission, but remember, he was not actually Jewish, just a good friend to Jews and especially to Israel. May he rest in peace. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Jonathan Edelman. He's at the University of Denver, the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies. He's been a professor there since 1978. He's also got his PhD originally from Columbia, has written or edited 12 books on Russia, China, and the Middle East, with a specialty in security studies, foreign policy, and revolutions. Been an honorary professor at two universities in China and many other places, including Alabama, which for some reason strikes me as funny after China, but don't tell that to any of our listeners in Alabama. We were talking about the Arab Spring earlier in the show, and I was in Israel very recently, spent a lot of time with the foreign ministry, heard from a whole bunch of experts, and talked to a lot of Israelis, and not a single Israeli, including members of Knesset, expressed any positive feelings about the fall of all the kleptocracies or the potential fall of some of the rest of them.
Well, I think the reason is very clear. Take Egypt, for example. Hosni Mubarak was a dictator, but Hosni Mubarak was our friend. I mean, Hosni Mubarak prevented, you know, any diplomatic relations with Iran. He put the squeeze on Hamas in Gaza. Hosni Mubarak was very much putting pressure, on the West Bank and on Fatah. I mean, basically, he was our friend, but compared to what we get now, where we're getting diplomatic relations with Iran, we got Iranian ships going through the Suez Canal, we've got the Rafah, juncture, passage is being opened. We see the support now for the Palestinians and for Hamas. You know, Hosni Mubarak is looking good to us, and we feel guilty. But
he was a moderately brutal thief. But
yeah, he didn't kill a lot of people.
No,
let's say.
I mean, not for the Arab world, really.
No, he actually was fairly tame, more intimidation than outright massacres, and he wasn't strange like Muammar Gaddafi. But the bottom line was that Israelis are feeling very worried, because even the changes we've seen, even if the Egyptian military does retain control, and Amr Moussa proves to be pliable, Muslim Brotherhood is coming up, and the Egyptian, they are going to be probably the number one party in the next election, so we have this fall. And Amr Moussa was the one, after all, we had the Egyptian pop song, I hate Israel, I love Amr Moussa. So they're feeling that at the very best, what once was considered a cold but nevertheless reliable ally against Iran, against Islamic fundamentalism, right, and against too close relationship with Turkey, is now flipping around in almost a kind of semi-Turkish reorientation of no enemies on the horizon. And that's getting the Israelis, really worried. Second thing that's getting them worried is the United States. I mean, you saw the popularity polls, I'm sure, when you were in Israel for Barack Obama, and what they're concerned about is that the American administration is using its force against Libya, but they're not doing anything about Bashar Assad. Now, there's, of course, conflicting concepts, but you saw Michael Oren come out just yesterday in the New York Times and make clear that, no, we would be happy to see him go. So I think what we're concerned about is presidents willing to use force in places that we don't regard as strategically important, but not willing to commit America. And we're still not even disabusing the notion that Bashar Assad is, as Hillary Clinton, who after all is definitely pro-Israel, you know, saying that he's sort of reformer, but he's disappointing. Well, I don't think...
I don't know. Genocide is a little disappointing. I mean, you know.
I mean, God.
Mass murders of drones. Yeah.
You just saw today, hundreds of tanks are going north. It's like having killed 1,100 people. Imagine if the Israelis kill 50 people. It's like, oh my God, the end of the world. Well, he kills, you know, retail, 1,000, 1,100 people, and he's killing a lot more, and the world just doesn't care. You know?
I was fascinated, and I wonder about your analysis of this, because President Obama's speech came just before Prime Minister Netanyahu arrived in the United States, and it was, you know, an attempt sort of to create a global American vision for the Middle East, in which he basically said, you know, well, Syria's trying, we hope they get better and stop doing bad things. And this is, I don't really get it. Why?
Well, I think as somebody who grew up in Washington, D.C., and did spend a little time in the previous administration, you know, not a Republican, but I think what happens is that the White House is a place uniquely secluded from the realities of the rest of the world. It's what we call the bubble. They got the bubble. And in that bubble, it's not a real world. You know, he doesn't go out to meet people. You know, he's in the bubble, secure with his Air Force One, and, you know, protected by Secret Service, but also protected heavily from reality. And this notion that he has had, and there's some good things about Barack Obama. I mean, the military relationship is very good. The security relationship is very good.
Right. The intelligence relationship is apparently very close, too.
Yeah. Military, intelligence, all of that stuff can get an A for. He's done extremely well in that stuff. But when it comes to vision, I think he still sounds so much like my colleagues. He is so Hyde Park. He is so Morningside Heights. You know, it's not even Jeremiah Wright. You can go there. But I think it's more the university stuff, because he sounds exactly like them. Just yesterday, one of my colleagues was talking to me, and she knows that I'm that rare bird, like 2 out of 27 in our faculty who's pro-Israel. And she says, and she means well, and she just says, well, I don't understand why these Israelis, and she's Jewish, she said, I don't understand these Israelis, you know, they keep building these settlements and that's destroying the opportunities for peace. So what are you going to say about that? And I think Barack Obama has something of that attitude, which is, I don't think he necessarily hates Israel, but I think he's got this vision thing. And the vision is, you heard him say in Poland, I'm sure you caught this, Rabbi, that he said that Warsaw should be a beacon for the Middle East. Well, hell, if does he understand that a third to half the people there are illiterate or semi-literate? They're averaging $100 a month. I mean, as much as we have a history, obviously, with the Poles, we would certainly grant them that they're, by comparison, a relatively economically, educationally, you know, advanced society. And even more so, Budapest, of course, and Prague, and, you know, so forth. And so he's transposing a vision that is more appropriate for Eastern Europe, more appropriate for the West, and saying, well, in these very areas, to use a politically incorrect word, backward areas, but they really are backward, it's also appropriate, without realizing that bringing democracy in many parts of the Middle East, that the Israelis are afraid, brings the ignorant masses into politics. And the result can be devastating. I mean, look at the history, like February Revolution in Russia, and it brings communism. Look at the German Revolution in 1918, and within 15 years, we get fascism. French Revolution, and we get militarism. So I think he just doesn't know his history, and he has that academic sense that ideas can transform realities. And they do. And as you know, religious ideas can absolutely do that. But secular ideas take a very long time, generations. And you caught, I was in the audience because I give talks at APEC Policy Conference, and the thing that struck me was when he said, you know, we can't stand this situation for 10 or 20 years more in the Middle East. Well, hello? We've been dealing with this for 100 years now. My grandfather was a Zionist leader in the 1920s in South Jersey, and if he were still alive, he would say, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, it's sort
these
of the
are the hard realities we face.
Right. I'm not entirely surprised, but it is stunning. I've been in Egypt seeing people living in tombs, knowing they're, you know, making $1,200 a year, maybe, if they're lucky. This doesn't get transformed overnight.
It takes generations. And you've got to start, if you want to know my opinion, I teach Chinese politics. You really start with the economy. You look what the Chinese have done. It's phenomenal. You look at the four tigers of Asia. You know, you need an economic base for political superstructure. They do not have it. GNP in the United States is $44,000 per person. In Egypt, it's $2,500. That's the beginning, and that's the end, in my mind, of the discussion. You got to change that reality, or it's hopeless.
You know, one of the factors that I don't think people pay much attention to is there's a lot of people very jealous of Israel because Israel's GNP, Israel's continued development, Israel's actually weathering this recession without apparent bumps.
7% growth rate in the last quarter.
Yeah, I mean, we're praying to get back to a growth rate.
Right.
You know, I keep telling everybody I'd be happy to trade Ben Bernanke for Stanley Fisher any day of the week.
God forbid he becomes head of IMF. We want to keep him there. He's done a great job. You know, he's from Zimbabwe originally.
Yes, actually. So here's my question. They're not going to stop being jealous of Israel.
No.
What is there that the United States can really do in this circumstance, and what is it that Israel can do?
Well, I think two answers to what you said. The first part is you're absolutely right, which nobody understands, but that a large part of the Arab world is very jealous. A large part of the Arab world has actually seen Israel. When I was there in 86 teaching at Hebrew University, we had Palestinians all over the country. They do know what Israel is. And there's a wonderful article that you may have seen by Fouad Ajami, who's at Johns Hopkins,
yes,
where he talks about the Arab envy of Israel. Did you see that, Rabbi?
I did see it.
Yeah, and it's wonderful because he says, I go to every year, and, you know, because he's originally from South Lebanon, and he goes through the Middle East. He went to Damascus and to Cairo and Riyadh, and he says all the time the Arab intellectuals complain, you know, we don't have any democracy, the standard of living is terrible, we've got no civil rights. And Fouad Ajami says that when he hears this for the 800th time from Arab intellectuals, he stops them cold by saying, isn't there one place in the Middle East that has all those things? And you know what happens? They say nothing because they understand that's Israel. So there is that love-hate relationship there. I think the reality is two things. First of all, we need a realist foreign policy, just like we had towards the Soviet Union, and we need it bipartisan. And what that would mean is that we focus and understand that we should not be, like the president did yesterday, be lecturing one of the leaders of Bahrain for repressing the Shiites. Because yes, they shouldn't be doing as much as they do. But on the other hand, Bahrain, that's why the Saudis send in their troops in the UAE. Do we want to see Saudi Arabia go down? Do we want Bahrain to go down? We have to be realists. Look, in World War II, our biggest ally was the Soviet Union. And I don't hear people complaining that they lost 27 million dead and we lost 300,000. We've got to realize that in the real world, you have to be a realist. And who more needs to be realist than we do? Secondly, we need to focus more on economic change. And that's very long run. It takes at least 10, 20, 30 years. Chinese have been at this since 1978. But if we can get economic change, really improve the education system, the economic system, the exports, that begins to create a totally different dynamic, like in the Four Tigers, where by the 1980s, Taiwan, which had martial law, suddenly moved to democracy, South Korea moved to democracy, even Singapore sort of moved to democracy. We got to create that base and recognize it just doesn't exist right now. Just final point. Look at Libya. You see, the administration, I'm sure you caught this, the administration is now concerned that the rebels are going to win. It was in the New York Times. They're concerned that the people were bombing the hell out of Gaddafi, and God knows Gaddafi is a terrible person, but we don't know who we're bringing to power. And right, all of a sudden, the people, that's what I'm talking about, the bubble. They were like, as long as against Gaddafi, it's fine. And now all of a sudden, they're worried because, oh my God, they're Islamists, and they're even more worried about Yemen.
I want to thank Jonathan Edelman for a great visit on Too Jewish. Could go on a great deal longer, but we're out of time. Maybe we can get you back when Palestine decides to declare itself in September and talk about that.
Be happy to return.
Thanks, Jonathan. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Well, thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Sarah Weiss-Maudi, the Israeli Foreign Ministry's expert on maritime law and flotillas. Although Shavuot was last week and we finished counting the Omer, here's a last listen to the classic concert version of the prayer Sheyabana Beis HaMikdash, Rebuild the Temple Speedily in Our Day. Our playout comes from cantors Avram Fried, Ohad Moskovitz, Yitzchak Meir Helfgott, and David Fisher. Quite a quartet. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sechel geinu v'zayro sechon Shema yezinga b'zol sheyivon Ebeis ha-migdosh Imei rave yomeinu Sechel geinu v'zayro sechon
Oitate futi, tate zise, tate futi
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.